Ready?
Born ready.
All right. Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of your favorite political podcast, Where the Party At. I am your host, Saba Long. We are changing it up. It's been a while since we've had a guest in the studio, and I am delighted to have the one and only Dr. Stephen Owens. You might be the first PhD we've had.
All right.
On the pod. I'm not sure. I have to double check. I'm going to read you his bio. Dr. Stephen Owens is the education director at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. We'll talk about what that is. I know that's a lot of words. He advocates for diverse, inclusive, and excellent public schools through research and data analysis. And why we have Dr. Owens, I'm just going to call you Stephen, on the pod today is we're going to talk about some legislation that has happened at the state capitol that we want you to pay attention to, even if you don't have kids, even if you're not planning to have kids, okay? So let's dive right in.
Great.
Stephen, just give us a little bit more flavor on who you are. Why is education the policy area that you've chosen and you're focused in on, and just a little bit of your story?
Absolutely. So first of all, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I have been working at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute for about 6 years now. We are a research and advocacy organization. Before then, at the Georgia Department of Education, implementing laws that were put in place that I felt like were immoral or just incorrect. And so this position, being able to advocate for just inclusive public schools, I jumped at the opportunity to, because I learned it, my time in the classroom, my time in graduate school, I genuinely believe that the public education system in the United States, if implemented well, is one of the best instances of good governance that we have. It's one of the few institutions we have that serves the vast majority of people regularly and is forced by penalty of the force of law to serve every child with at least an angle towards equity. And it's not always doing that. And so I'm always constantly pushing at least Georgia public schools to do that well for students. And it also is one of the few places where I feel like we can begin to undo the consequences of generations of oppression and of theft based on people's race, income, ability, language proficiency. Now, it's making it sound like a panacea, but there are just so few places in American society right now that is forced to take everyone and then provide a service to communities that is also in communities beloved. The fact that we see regularly in surveys that people rate their local schools with an A or a B, even as they think the entire public education system is doing much worse, there's this paradox where people really do like their schools and want it to succeed. And so at GBPI, the way that we do that is to try to study the budget as this moral document. How well is it serving the people of Georgia? Who do our lawmakers believe deserves the state's wealth and resources? And then who do they feel like should be taken from? And so at our organization, we're coming from that position of the system, the generations of white supremacist policies have taken from specifically people of color. And that we imagine a state where our government is realigned so that it equitably distributes resources to mitigate that harm. Now, I know that's a really big way of describing that I'm particularly looking at those kids who've been left out of the education conversation and seeing that they are given more of the state's resources.
When I think about the Georgia General Assembly, a lens towards equity is not something that comes to mind.
No.
So how do you reconcile that with the reality?
It's hard. A lot of it is imagining a world that may be several years away or might be several generations away. There are a lot of surprising instances like that. The Hope Scholarship is one. Georgia Pre-K is another that we really showed the rest of the nation what it looks like to use lottery funds well, and the fact that we had and continue to have free pre-K for all four-year-olds, anyone who enrolls and is close to a center, That is a more equitable use of our tax dollars than has been used in the past. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it looks like pushing for equity in a way that maybe folks who are against the idea of equity would be for a program like that. And so sometimes it looks like couching our policies in how does it help the economy or how does it help public health? Because we don't think that those things are at odds. But if we want a strong economy, it has to be strong for everyone. So who is like Georgia's economy not serving right now? People that the state has been systematically oppressing for generations. It looks like having a workforce that includes folks with disabilities. It looks like an education system that includes kids whose parents don't speak English. And so targeting those families and communities is equitable, even if I don't use that word in the way that I advocate with some lawmakers who, for one reason or another, are against the idea of equity because they feel like it's at odds with their community thriving.
Got it. So this is Tuesday when you're going to hear this. There's only going to be a couple more days left in the legislative session. And there's a bill that has already made its way through, and I think it's now at the governor's desk.
That's right.
Senate Bill 233, which is a private school voucher bill that where was the political stance, Republicans versus Democrats? Did any Democrats support the bill?
I think one Democrat in the House supported it, not a single Democrat in the Senate supported it. I will say this is a policy. To go back a little bit, private school voucher is public funds for private educational expenses. So this bill would provide $6,500 for any family in the school enrolled in the bottom 25% in the way that we rank schools.
Right.
That a lot of folks called failing schools, and I have a lot of problems with that designation, but we can talk about that later. They're not doing as well as the rest of the state, though. There's any way you look at it, they're not doing as well as the rest of the state. And so if your child is enrolled in one of those schools, you can get a $6,500 voucher starting in the fall of 2025
to go to a private school. Year.
Every year.
Every school year.
Absolutely. To go to a private school or to be homeschooled. And this is, if you poll folks, this goes across the ideological perspective. There are a lot of very progressive folks who are in favor of vouchers, very conservative folks who are in favor of it. And as we've seen in our polling, the vast majority of the folks in the middle are absolutely against it. So there have been traditionally a lot of Democrats that have supported this in Georgia. Since then, the House Democratic Caucus specifically has taken a stance against it, saying this is a caucus position. So last year, when this exact bill failed, only one Democrat voted for it, and she switched to becoming a Republican.
Misha Maynard. We've talked about her on the pod before.
That's exactly right. And has since shown a lot more very conservative views than I think we saw prior to her change in party affiliations. And so, yes, there is kind of a red-blue split, but it gets much murkier in the polling. And I'll say we did some polling with the University of Georgia as well. And while we found that there is a strong, 15 to 20% of people who are pro-school voucher no matter what, the vast majority of Georgians want more support for these schools or more public school choice. So think charter schools, dual enrollment, more opportunities inside the school. And so while there is that support there, it's nowhere near what the vast majority of Georgians want. The vast majority of Georgians want their schools to be given enough money to meet the needs of their children.
Right. And so this is a cost to the state of about $140 million a
year. That's exactly right.
Producer Keith has a question.
is there a difference in private and charter schools? Can you explain that to the...
Keith, thank you so much for asking that. There is a huge difference. Now, GBPI does not have a historical stance against or about charter schools. We feel like that is a tool in the toolbox, right? The main difference is that charter schools are publicly... Like they are public schools, even though there is kind of private management at that, that all the teachers are state employees. These are schools that have to, and I'm going to put it in the negative, but I'm going to come back to it, have to accept every single child that comes in her doors, no matter the language they speak at home, the ability, income, race, sexuality, gender orientation. Now, that is regularly used as this kind of apology for public schools. It's like, oh, we have to accept everyone. Private schools don't have to accept everyone.
They can cherry pick the best students.
Absolutely. I just, in my own growth, I want to rethink the way that we think about those schools. That if you have a school that can only quote unquote succeed, if they reject large numbers of students, that is an abject failure. That is an exclusionary, discriminatory institution. And I'm tired of pretending like they're successes. We see the Harvards of this world. We see like what it looks like for schools that reject everyone except kind of who they deem the best of the best. I think that's an abject failure.
Okay, so Stephen, you were talking about on your soapbox.
I know. I get really into
about,
it.
About the difference between charters and private and this connotation that, you know, private schools are able to select the best of the best.
Right. And the fact that it's treated like a good thing, it really bothers me. Like being able to reject a child because they're trans, because their parents are gay, because they're not an evangelical Christian, that is not a success in my book. Mm-hmm. And so charter schools, like traditional public schools, every single child who enrolls is going to be served in one way or another. And if they do a poor job of it, the parents have the ability to either reelect the school board members, revoke the charter of this charter school, work to revoke that, or sue them in court. Versus a private school, if they want to say, like, sorry, your child's autistic, and we just don't do that, then they can. They have every right to. And this has been the traditional bargain, right? Y'all can be as exclusionary as you want.
As long as someone's willing to pay.
You don't get a dollar of our money.
Right.
Exactly. This started because folks wanted to get around Brown v. Board of Education. That is, the proliferation of private schools in the American South came about because folks did not want their children to go to school with Black children. And a lot of those schools are still in operation today and will now start receiving even more state funding because instead of addressing the needs that these schools have, our public schools have, the state of Georgia has decided to make it a parent problem and say it must be your fault. So good luck. I'll give you $6,500 and best of luck to you. And I don't judge any parent that has to make that really difficult decision. I hate the fact that the state of Georgia looks at our parents and says, I will give you the chance at a good education if you trade away some of your kids' rights because you do not have the protections for students with disabilities inside these schools. For students based on gender ideology, sexual orientation, language proficiency. So it's treated like a gift. It's treated like, here's $6,500. Do whatever you want with it. But it's a negotiation where the terms are hidden. And for that reason, we've had longstanding opposition to that. So that was a very roundabout answer to your question.
So if I'm a parent of a child and I want to take that $6,500 and put my kid in a Christian private school, I can do that.
If they take your child.
If yes. They take my child.
Yes.
And then, I don't know if you would know this, but what's the average annual cost of private school in Georgia?
It's about double, $12,000 to $13,000. There are a lot of very cheap private schools, but let me be clear, they are terrible.
Right.
And I think, and there are excellent private schools in Georgia and Atlanta, but my kids aren't getting into Paideia with $6,500.
No.
or St. Pius, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so what we see in a lot of other states, the bigger you make these programs is these terrible private schools just pop up out of nowhere. And they'll take your $6,500. They'll be exactly $6,500. And they'll take your money and they will provide some of the worst education we've measured in regards to once these programs become universal. Y'all saw a lot of people complain about schools closing for COVID. Some of the programs that we've measured in other states like Ohio and Louisiana and Indiana show worse student outcomes transferring to those private schools for these kids than the hit due to COVID-19. Mm. So it is one of the worst education interventions we have measured in the United States if they even take your child. So.
Right. So what is the impact on the public schools?
It's going to be slow but undeniable. So, you know, year one and two, we're not going to feel that big of an impact. There will be a lot of kids who would have gone to private school anyway, because you can for kids enrolling in kindergarten, even if they never went to a public school, they can get $6,500 to now go to a private school. A lot of the richer parents who were already considering private school will take their kids out and take that $6,500, and it'll hurt these schools specifically because they're going to be losing these students, which is how their funding is dictated. A big portion of their funding is dictated. And it will just make things worse for all the kids that remain, because until you lose enough students, all of your fixed costs remain.
Right.
You can't cut off, if you lose three kids from your school, you can't cut off three seats on the bus or turn down the air conditioning, three students amount. So you just have thousands of dollars less. And that means, we know what that looks like based on years of budget cuts from the state of Georgia. Less arts and music classes, older buses. It looks like having a lot more long-term subs instead of a full-time teacher. So we'll slowly see the quality of education, unless the state makes a change and starts supporting these schools better and more equitably, we'll just see the quality of education slowly go down for the 90% of kids who remain.
And is there a provision in the bill that requires, that has some requirements for the private schools?
It is basement level. Yes, you have to be either accredited or in the process of accreditation for one of the private school accrediting agencies. From my own research, we have a couple of vouchers already, one for students with disabilities. They have the similar requirements, either accredited or in the process of accreditation. There are several schools that have been in the process of accreditation for years. So if those kids, by my understanding, graduate from that school, the kids are not eligible for the Hope Scholarship because they don't have any accreditation. They might have to get a GED after they get their diploma, because there's no body that says that this is a quality
education. That you received a quality education.
Exactly.
Right.
The teachers don't have to have bachelor's degrees. You don't have to show any evidence of strong financial management. You can just have some sort of promise that we have the capital to do this. And so, yeah, there are some requirements, but they are very little. Your teachers don't have to have background checks. I mean, it's really scary how low of a bar it is, specifically now that we have this public funding. And you can make the argument, and I will right now, that we should hold private schools in Georgia to a higher standard already. And so the fact that we haven't, it makes it clear that this bill, and bills like this that we've seen in Georgia, are overly deferential to the private schools, not to the families that desperately want a better education.
Kemp's argument, Governor Kemp, his argument is that this bill shows his commitment to education. This plus the fact that in the last, the past two budget cycles, I think he's given additional funding for teachers, in part because the impact of COVID and teachers leaving the profession. What's the flip side of that coin that maybe folks aren't seeing?
I do think that several years of teacher pay raises or cost of living adjustments, that you can make a really strong argument that he has personally led the charge to teachers getting more money from the state government than any other governor in Georgia's history. I think that he is absolutely right on that. And he's made some other, specifically in the budget, some overtures towards education that would support that. The Constitution is clear that the primary obligation of the state of Georgia shall be an adequate public education system.
And who determines the word adequate?
Courts. No, I mean, we haven't had a strong challenge since about 2005 about how do we have an adequate public education system? I think you can make a very strong case that if lawmakers spent all year calling one out of every four schools in the state failures, then whose failure is that? That is a failure of a state government to not adequately support her own citizens. So I don't think propping up private schools shows any sort of commitment to education. That if we were concerned about the education of children, then we would follow the research that shows, and the polling that shows, that you can provide funding, equitable funding, that actually does make a real difference in students' lives and change their outcomes. And so a point I'll make on this, he went out of this way this past 2 years to really push for this private school voucher because we got to do something for these kids. Because
it almost passed last cycle.
It did.
It almost passed last session.
Lost by like 5 votes.
Right. By an unforced error on the part of Republicans.
What do you mean?
If I recall, there was a mailer sent out.
Oh, that was a couple years ago. No, last year.
Oh, that was okay. That was two sessions ago.
That was wild. They have had a few unforced errors in this, which I really appreciate. No, last year it just 16 House Republicans broke with the caucus and at the last second voted against it. But they have made many unforced errors in the past. And so to have the governor for 2 years say, I got to do something for these kids, while at the same time, Georgia is one of only 6 states without any specific funding to support students living in poverty. We have one of the highest child poverty rates in the nation. We are in the great city of Atlanta with the highest income inequality in the nation. It is incredibly cruel to be poor in the state of Georgia. You don't have Medicaid expansion. We have terrible cash assistance. Fines and fees, so that ticket you get, support our cities financially more than any other state in the nation, right? So it is very, very difficult to be poor in Georgia, and we don't have a single dollar in the education funding formula to support those kids. So to have the governor, go ahead.
Could you explain that? You said we're one of 6 states.
Without any specific funding to educate students living in poverty.
So what does that funding look like?
So the way that our formula works, you've got your base level child, base level. It's a 9th through 12th grader in general education. Everyone who's in a program that requires more money is guaranteed that. So the way they wrote this bill, the way they wrote this funding formula, kids in kindergarten need smaller class sizes. So they get about twice the amount the 9th through 12th grader gets. And then you can imagine from that, them building out this formula like, oh, well, students in special education need even smaller class sizes, so they get even more money. Kids in gifted program get a little bit more money, or CTAE. There's these 19 different weights based on the needs of the child, and not anywhere in there is the income of the parents. And for the past 30 years, every other state, save us and 5 others, have realized that there's this huge gaping hole in the way they fund schools. Is that if you have 2 kids arriving at the same school and one whose parents make $150,000 and one whose parents are making $30,000 and they're expected to do the same academically, they can. They genuinely can. There's no connection between intelligence and income. But that means that we need to provide the resources that poorer kids, like parents, can't afford inside the school, right? And so like while the richer kid, which is nothing wrong with being rich, they can get that tutoring, after school enrichment, you know what I mean? They can go to the zoos over the summer. Like, but the kid from low income, I mean, that was me growing up, single mom, with 2 older brothers. Like, what does that look like? How do you support the needs of that child? And we recognize that all else in the formula. Like, oh, that's what we need to do for students with special needs. That's what we need to do for kids learning English. But we haven't recognized the number one most impactful thing to student test scores. And so they treat it just like those kids must be dumb or those schools must be terrible. But the connection of the number of kids you have living in poverty and how schools are doing on these state tests, that's a straight line. And we're not providing a single dollar additionally to support it.
So a Title I school isn't receiving more per pupil?
Not based on the state funding formula. Like they're getting a little bit more in federal dollars, but that's true nationwide. But the fact that the state isn't putting that on top. And the research shows what people call the achievement gap, you know, that difference in test scores between, let's say, people of color and white kids. First of all, that's a complete myth because there's no intelligence gap. It's an opportunity gap between those.
Right.
Can be 100% closed if you provide 20% more funding for every year the child is in school. That thing goes away. And if we don't do that, then we're saying that that those other kids must be dumber. Like,
so
I'm okay with living in a world where white kids and Asian kids
compared to the cost of this Senate bill what does that cost?
Oh, it would be huge. It would be, I mean, 21% on top of that, we'd be talking hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And but that's the cost of educating an informed populace. That's what, right now we're paying for it, except we're paying it in our criminal legal system. We're paying for it in our public health. How expensive is it to have a bunch of kids not graduate high school or not have the funds to go to college? So we pay for it. We just pay for it on the back end. We have more of our own citizens in prison than any other state in the nation. That's paying for it. So, and I know that that's, you know, you aren't saying that we shouldn't do
say,
it.
Say that again for the people. Georgia is what?
We have number one in the nation of her own percentage of her own citizens in prison, incarcerated, than any other state in the nation.
Wow.
Those are folks who have kids in school. Those are folks who that is voter suppression, as well as keeping kids behind in school. If you've got, you know, if your mom is in prison because she can't make bail and she hasn't even been tried in court yet, that affects student outcomes as well. But yeah, it's a team game, and there are a lot of things that need to be changed, but I don't see, like, where are we going to kind of go out of our way to actually support these folks? Because again, the number of things we're doing to hold back folks, and when you know the history of our state and racism, it is impossible to understand the way that we fund schools, the way that we think about our jails and who deserves to be in jail and who doesn't, without understanding racism. It's the thread that ties it all together.
You won't have disagreement from the two of us on that.
Prove me wrong, but
I think putting on my like political realist hat,
yeah,
is like, how do you move the needle in a state where the majority of the electeds in the General Assembly are Republican,
mm-hmm.
where Democrats don't have power at the state level? And I would argue, and we've talked about this on the pod before, that Democrats don't hold Republicans to account and don't hold Governor Kemp to account.
Yeah.
There have been plenty of opportunities for the Democratic Party of Georgia and Democrats across, you know, in elected leadership to go after Kemp and others for a variety of political decisions, right? Legislative decisions, budget decisions, but that does not happen.
Yeah.
So it sounds great. I didn't say I was good at
my job. I just said I'm doing it. No, I do think that there's an argument to be made where the vast majority of Georgians agree. And I think that it's a change that's going to seem like it's impossible until it happens all at once. So I do think that eventually we will have funding to support students living in poverty, because it's going to become a gnat.
It's going to be too big to ignore.
Absolutely. And it's something that I've seen folks, Republicans and Democrats, they have recognized that this is something that we have to at least have an answer for, or actually meet it in the budget. Will it be an adequate dollar amount off the top? No, it won't. But it'll start moving us that direction. And I think that there's a place to make the argument, even for folks who aren't comfortable with the truth of how white supremacy has placed in our state, can still recognize that to ignore the economic situation of huge swaths of Georgians is fiscally irresponsible. And so I think there's an opening there to talk about things that the state's been resistant against, about more money in the 0-3 space, about criminal legal systems reform, about increasing the minimum wage, or even the lowest hanging fruit, expanding Medicaid. I think that there will be a time when we're surprised by how quickly things move. But it is, I'm not going to lie, it's difficult. It is difficult, yeah, to talk to folks who think that all of their good fortune came because of hard work and everyone else's misfortune came because of foolishness. That is, deep down, I could not disagree with that more. And it also just makes for foolish public policy if we ignore everyone the second they make a mistake. So you have to be perfect. And then the second you make some sort of financial or moral mistake, you are allowed to be removed from the populace is a really dangerous way to run a state.
Yeah. You mentioned 0-3, and I know there was a bill that I believe it's a bill or it's a conversation about creating a child first trust fund.
Oh, yeah.
So this is Representative Lisa Campbell, who I think represents an area of Cobb County and maybe another county as well. Are you familiar with that?
Our organization came up with it.
Okay.
Absolutely. So I think it's a lot of...
Like, explain, like, what is that? This isn't like the focus, but I know it's related. And so I just want to give people some context of what that is, even though it's not going to happen in this legislative session.
Absolutely. So as I know that, you know, and your listeners probably also know, Georgia had about $16 billion left over at the end of last year in a surplus, or we can call it surplus or we can call it unpaid wages. But let's call it a surplus for now. Just that could be used for any purpose whatsoever, an insane amount of money. And our organization thought really hard about, okay, what are some things that we could be using this for? Because not only is this great one-time funds, but it shows the state could be making a lot more money, could be serving her constituents a lot better. And this is one that we came up with, and I believe it was, let's take $7.5 billion, so not even half of the total amount, put it in a trust fund, and say that the returns we get on it, we came up with 5.8%, because that's what the teacher's pension says that they get every year. Long story short, this is a very conservative case. We're going to make more than that on this amount. But put $7.5 billion into an account, and we could get hundreds of millions of dollars every single year just on the interest from it. Georgia has almost no supports for families with children 0-3. So what if we put that hundreds
of millions? We were talking about this earlier.
We're right in the middle of it. Yeah. I got a 14-month-old about to have another baby. Just like it's a barren wasteland. And it's expensive everywhere. And no one's making a lot of money because the childcare centers aren't getting rich either.
Right.
That's a failure of the state to actually support families in that space. So this would generate hundreds of millions of dollars that could go to that, either in direct subsidies to parents or supporting childcare centers so they lower tuition. It's a lot of money that could be used that way, and it would not cost a single additional dollar in tax funds. The money's already there.
And what's the appetite or response?
Silence.
DOA.
I think a lot of lawmakers are against the idea of starting any new program. And then you'll talk to some lawmakers who genuinely don't think the state should do anything for specifically moms. I think it's hard to separate that from sexism, that like women should be home with children. And if we support this, then we are.
But if you care about, if you use the argument of Georgia's a great place to do business, which is, probably the number one thing you'll hear the governor say, then it also needs to be a great place for workers. Workers need their children to have a place that they can put them in and they can go work.
So absolutely.
You can look at this purely through capitalistic lens and see that, okay, maybe there is a there with this.
And what about like changing some of the narrative? Because like we were talking earlier, I stay at home. I work from home.
Yeah.
And I stay at home with my 3-year-old. Have been doing for the past 3 years. So you say moms, but maybe, reaching out to some dads as well, because the demographics have changed.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And if there is a subsidy that could, balance some of this out, back to Zaba's point, we all know, we can get a little help with the childcare. We definitely could make some more money.
Absolutely.
I think that speaks to everybody.
And it maybe shows the hypocrisy of the number one state to do business. Because if that were true, we would have a higher minimum wage, right? We have a minimum wage that's like $2 less than the federal minimum wage.
Yeah,
not a lot of people are getting paid, but people with disabilities are.
Yeah,
they're getting paid under $7.25, and also $7.25 is insane.
Yeah, we've talked about that a lot on the pod.
So we are a great state to own a business. We are a great state that if you can project the creation of jobs, you can get some money from the state. Number one, to do business. Yeah, that's hard to make that case if parents can't work or are kept from working more.
Right.
Because of that.
Which we saw happen during the pandemic.
Absolutely. Right.
And it particularly hit women, or women were not coming back to the workforce at the rate that men were.
And there's a lot of elements of that. There are so many programs where the benefits cut off the second you make over this dollar amount. Instead of stepping down, that creates this perverse incentive. Like, I would love to get 10 more hours a week at my job. But if I do that, then I'm going to lose this 0-3 subsidy I have, the CAPS program. So there's some common sense ways that are not super progressive that like libertarians and conservatives and Democrats all agree on. You're pushing up against just a lot of inertia to do nothing. And doing nothing is a very powerful argument for a lot of lawmakers. That like if they don't see it in their immediate world, and that can be people across the political spectrum, then why would I, you know, stick my neck out to do this? And the state of Georgia traditionally has put just so much authority behind the governor.
Right.
That if he wanted to do this, it would be done.
Yeah.
But we see that in Medicaid expansion, something that I think the vast majority of lawmakers want to do, but the governor has made it so clear that that's not in his plans. So hundreds of thousands of people go without health insurance. Maybe because one person doesn't want to do that plan.
Right. So for the person listening who says, I don't have kids, or I'm not planning to have kids anytime soon, or I'm never having kids, why should they care about the education policies that we've been talking about?
First of all, enjoy your sleep. Those of you never want to have children. That is incredible. I will say one day, these folks who are other people's kids are going to be your dentist. They are going to be driving your bus, picking up your trash, operating on you. It benefits everyone to have an electorate that knows how to do their jobs well. Also, it is just a economic multiplier. We saw what it was like during the pandemic when everyone, when we passed down policies, it's just like every person for themselves. But my family's flourishing depends on Saba doing well, Keith doing well, your children, you know what I mean? Like we're all going to be together for several years. And also your tax dollars are at work. That even if you don't have a child, you are paying taxes into a system and you have every right to hold that system accountable. And which is why I completely understand if you have a parent, if you have someone who has no kids in public school, still not wanting those funds to go to a private parochial school, because that goes against a pretty standard understanding of the Constitution, which is there should be a separation of church and state. And so I think we should all be concerned and activated to make sure everyone's child does right. Because my community goes further than just who's living in my house. And these are my friends, my friends' kids. This is kind of the entire experiment we're a part of in democracy. So I would encourage them to be active participants in this and to wish for the success of all children, not just some who may or may not be with them.
So just wrapping up, what would you recommend folks to watch or read or listen to better understand this education conversation, school vouchers, a 0-3 program like this trust fund, just kind of broadly some resources to read, watch, listen to?
Absolutely. You can always go to gbpi.org, which is our organization's website where we have posts on this. I'm also a part of a coalition called Fund Georgia's Future, which is fighting for a just education system with fair and full funding. And we have emails that we send out kind of what's happening in the education policy space. If you're not interested in joining a coalition, even though you should very much consider it, there are a lot of great resources by the Georgia School Boards Association or one of the Teachers Associations page, or Georgia Association of Educators, where they'll send out emails of this is what's happening, that go a long way in showing what's happening under the Gold Dome and how to support kids that way. But I'm biased. Fund Georgia's Future, I think, is doing a really good job of rethinking not only what our schools should look like, but what advocacy should look like. We don't want just a different version of the public schools we have now with like teachers paid a little bit better, even though teachers should be paid.
And who's behind Fund Georgia's Future?
GBPI is the lead organization, but we have a steering committee with regional and state organizations and grassroots. So Migrant Equity Southeast, the Deep Center down in Savannah, the People's Agenda, Georgia Youth Justice Coalition, SEF, SPLC, IDRA, like a lot of great organizations, but then a dozen plus of other organizations that are part of it, because we've made it clear in our mission that we want to center the voices of people of color and people of color led organizations outside of Metro Atlanta. And it doesn't mean that Metro Atlanta is some panacea, but that is the group of folks that we saw was most absent or silenced in the education debates. So we wanted to make sure that those folks who were closest to the pain would eventually be closest to the power. And so that's our hope, is that by centering those voices and those issues, we can push for a public system, public education system that actually serves everyone. Not just, we don't want to just stop vouchers. We want to make sure that every single child reaches their potential. And so we had to broaden the coalition for that exact reason. It's not just, you know, a different type of white issues.
Yeah. All right. Any parting words, anything else that you want to cover? Any questions that you wanted to ask, but we didn't get to?
No, you did a very good job. I will say there's still things to be excited about in the budget right now. The like state has about $200 million that's about to be put into our school bus system that will make our buses newer, and we can do shorter routes. We can pay bus drivers better. Which has been a
big challenge.
Huge challenge.
Across the state, not just in Metro Atlanta.
Absolutely. Where kids are on the bus for hours each day, they're missing classes, missing breakfast, or buses are breaking down. Bus drivers are making $10, $15 an hour to put 70 minors on a bus, which is my nightmare. And they're doing it by themselves. So you can see it, and I think categorize it as a public health crisis to not adequately fund that exact program. And then just an argument that I feel like is at the root of a lot of what I'm fighting against is a scarcity mindset that just like Georgia doesn't have enough money, so let's just cut up the pie how best we can. And then, you know, good luck to everyone. And what I'll say is Georgia is actually one of the richest states and the richest countries in the history of the world. We pretend like we aren't via like unaccountable tax breaks, via refusing revenue in a lot of areas like Medicaid expansion. We pretend like we're poor and we leave low-income folks holding the bill. And so that's at the heart of so many of these arguments I've seen, and I hear it from Democrats and Republicans, that just they are so afraid of talking about revenue in any way whatsoever. They just say like, oh, this must be how it is. When in reality, we are just incredibly wealthy, and we give so much of that money away to folks who are already wealthy, and then tell everyone else good luck. And that is... not only is that morally cruel, that is also really poor public policy, because we want all of our neighbors to succeed.
So if you woke up one day and Governor Kemp called you and he said, Stephen, what's the number one thing I should do to address education in Georgia?
Pass Medicaid expansion. It wouldn't even be inside the school. I mean, there are a lot of things that need to happen inside the school, but I would be hard pressed. And maybe that's just the easiest one. High minimum wage. Allow unions in Georgia so workers can push for their own protections instead of waiting on a Stephen or a Governor Kemp to do it for them.
Well, in the legislative session, I think we talked about this on the pod a few episodes ago, the bill that did end up getting passed that if you are a company that has received state incentives and your employees want to unionize, you cannot automatically recognize that union until they've gone through the entire approval process through the National Union Board.
Yeah.
And if you do recognize it, the state will claw back the incentives.
Absolute disdain for workers. For the people who make the businesses that we support so highly in the state that actually make those businesses run. And so, yeah, I think that there's a lot of things that could be done that would affect student test scores way more than things like education funding related. But for some reason, people have a lot more, there's a lot more agreement on school funding in a way that there isn't in these other areas.
Right.
But yeah, I think minimum wage, that would, it's not a handout. It would just recognize people's labor and would pull so many people out of poverty by their own work that it would be absolutely amazing. But besides that, Medicaid expansion, yeah, labor unions, there's a good deal.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Stephen Owens, thank you for coming on the pod and talking about a wonky topic, but it's something that impacts all of us. It's something that we should care about. And that is the future of Georgia through the realm of education.
Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it.